quite a few things going on in the news, and certainly with the election of the Pope, it's something that we all need to be aware of and just keep our eyes open to the developments that are taking place. We've got these organised before I actually got up here. It's somewhere here. There we go. There are a couple of other items that I'd like to just draw your attention to. I have mentioned about the vote that's going on in France at the moment about the EU constitution. There is another article here about oui or non. EU insists that the voting goes on. This is coming from the Daily Telegraph, actually, of today. And it mentions here that Europe's pro-federalist leaders have launched a campaign to save the EU constitution from imminent death should France vote no in next month's referendum. Now, as I mentioned and brought out last time, the no vote in France is very different from the no vote in the UK. In the case of the UK, you're looking at a no against Europe generally. We were saying we're going too far into federalism. In the case of the no in France, it is we haven't gone far enough into federalism. And the no vote in France is that we need more unity and more federalism. But it says here, it says, the key to their plan B is to insist that countries due to hold votes later this year, or even next year, like Britain, carry on regardless of the result in France until all 25 member states have been given a chance to ratify a treaty. On the surface, there's no basis for holding further referenda if the French vote no. The draft European Constitution must be ratified by all member states, and a French no should effectively kill the treaty. However, the EU was not built on letting details like no votes sway its founding fathers from their mission. And this is the way it tends to go. In other words, they're going to go on regardless of what actually comes out as far as the referenda are concerned. After the Maastricht Treaty was voted down in Denmark and in Ireland, both countries were invited to vote again, and finally voted yes. And basically, you keep on voting until you finally get a yes vote. It's like the same as the Welsh Assembly. They were thrown out once, and they very nearly got thrown out the second time, but now they actually got in by the narrowest of margins. You try and get rid of them. It just doesn't work that way. Once you've got something, then that's it, and it just becomes more and more confused and more down the road that the politicians are wanting to take us. Faced with 21 consecutive opinion polls showing that the no camp is ahead in France, pro-constitution EU leaders have begun asserting that there is a moral, political, and even a legal obligation to carry on voting, an argument aimed squarely at Britain. So, it's something that is significant. We watch this space. Even if we do go to a no vote in France, it doesn't really mean to say that the juggernaut has actually stopped. Another article that's just appeared is in today's Telegraph was oil-hungry China takes Sudan under its wing. It says a metallic maze of chimneys and pipes and vents and so on, talking about the oil refinery over in Sudan's, it's the jewel in the crown of Sudan's military regime, and it forms the vital artery of a thriving oil industry that poured £1 billion into government coffers last year. Without this windfall gain, likely to be far larger this year, the president could not maintain his military machine, let alone wage war against the rebels. So this oil is very, very important to Sudan, to the present government in Sudan, and China apparently is taking this country under its wing. And China is generally extending its reach, extending its power in so many areas. Now that is significant, and particularly when you look at what's happening as far as the papacy is concerned. Because when you're looking at the papacy, with the new pope, I mean, this headline that appeared here, which is God's Rock Wheeler is the new pope, and a picture there of Cardinal Ratzinger, it says that to tumultuous cheers and applause, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, one of the most controversial figures in the modern church, emerged on the balcony of St. Peter's yesterday as the 265th pope. It says, however, the choice of the 78-year-old Bavarian was possibly the most contentious the cardinals could have made. While conservatives, particularly in Africa and Asia, will be delighted, many liberals in Europe and America will be dismayed. But the speed of the conclave, one of the shortest in history, showed that the great majority of cardinals were united behind him. Now, I don't know whether it actually was the shortest in history. I think the actual number of votes I saw a report, I couldn't get any more details, but they reckoned that it was the shortest, but you know, that it goes back a long way, so whether they were able to verify that. But it is something that certainly it's not just the election of a new pope, it's also what he stands for and what he's going to have to try and fight against. And the name is chosen as well, that tells us a great deal. Now, obviously, we can't go into the mind of the cardinals and the mind of the Catholic Church to a great degree, but there are certain challenges that, again, if I just read something from today's paper, regarding a gay marriage is a challenge to the Pope. It says, Spain presented the papacy of Benedict XVI with its first big challenge yesterday, when the Vatican and the socialist government of Roman Catholic country traded blows in a heated row over its plan to legalize homosexual marriage. The dispute erupted after the government of José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero drove a bill through the Cortes on Thursday that will allow homosexuals to marry and adopt children. The Vatican hit back yesterday by advising Spanish Catholic civil servants to refuse to officiate at homosexual weddings, and even if it meant risking losing their jobs. So, you know, the Vatican has certain power in that regard. It says Cardinal Trujillo, I think it is, said that the municipal officials asked to perform homosexual marriages should object on the grounds of conscience. I'm talking of every professional linked to the implementation of the law, he said. So again, the cardinal in Spain is saying this. It says, Maria Teresa Fernando de Lavegas, the Spanish Deputy Prime Minister, said that state officials must apply the laws that government proposes and Parliament approves. So it's a head-to-head between the Catholic Church and the socialist government. Now, when we look at what, in fact, happens as far as the pontiff is concerned. Another article that appeared on the day after his election, where it says, the pontiff must tackle a sea of troubles. It says, the new pope, Benedict XVI, will have heard at first hand in his past 2 weeks of the Vatican about many of the problems with which he will now have to grapple. During the daily meetings of the Vatican Synod Hall that began after the death of John Paul II, cardinals spoke frankly and passionately about their individual concerns, from worsening Vatican finances to militant Islam and AIDS. And it goes on, it says, his election will have delighted the conservatives in the Vatican, concerned that during John Paul II's reign, the administration of the church was neglected. It says, cardinals from Africa, Asia and Latin America will also be thrilled, because they will feel that he understands their fears about the advance of militant Islam and the inroads being made by evangelicals and sects. So that, again, is an interesting point we need to be aware of. Cardinal Ratzinger has consistently reiterated the superiority of Catholicism over other Christian denominations and faiths. An opponent of Turkey joining the European Union, he is wary that dialogue with Islam could dilute Catholicism, especially while Christians remain persecuted in a number of Muslim countries. So he's quite hard-headed in the case of Turkey. It says, there are a few in Europe now whose vocation for the priesthood are not plunging, where the vocation for the priesthood is not plunging, and church attendance dwindling as Catholics abandon the faith practiced by their parents. Even in bastions of Catholicism such as Spain and Ireland, the church no longer commands the obedience, and its authority has been undermined by the clergy abuse scandal. Liberals believe that the church's unpopular stance on the issues of the role of women in the church to homosexuality and the artificial birth control has driven many away. In England, there's such a dearth of new priests that there were only 18 ordinations last year, and in Dublin, there was only one. Lay people, for years kept in secondary roles, are now being encouraged to take increasing responsibility in the church. But the new pope has made clear that he disagrees with the liberal prescription for renewal. He believes that the way of to counter the tide of innovations sweeping the modern world is not to bend with them, but to hold to eternal truths until society itself sees the error of its ways. So it's very, very much a hardliner. He makes the following comment about liberation theology. It says, communist regimes which came to power in the name of liberation are one of the disgraces of our times. So he's against the kind of socialist movement, certainly, and he is going head to head. You know, on secularism, it says, a struggle exists, and so we must defend religious freedoms against an ideology which is held up as if it was the only voice of rationality. Negative birth rates and immigration are changing Europe's ethnic makeup. Above all, we've gone from being a Christian culture to one of aggressive secularism, which at times is intolerant. So his perspective and the way in which he's clearly going, or certainly seems to be going, is that he is wanting to, you know, return Catholicism within Europe. He's a German. Now, just as we had a Polish pope that took on communism head-on, we now seem to have a pope that is taking on the secularism and the leftish leanings, if you like, of our nations, or may well do this. Now, an awful... if I could just read one other... article from Wednesday, from the April 20th. It says, Habemus Papam, which means we have a pope. The new pope needs our prayers. It says, a spellbinding pause came after the words Habeas Papam were pronounced on the balcony of St. Peter's at 5:43 yesterday, before the name was given. And then came Joseph Ratzinger. Those watching in the city and the world waited during those seconds agog to know the identity of the new pope. But why should the world care who the new pope is? The answer lies in the extraordinary influence of the last papacy, of John Paul II. Geopolitically, it changed the face of the world, not least by bringing the Soviet Empire tumbling down. John Paul's importance was recognized by the turnout of world leaders at his funeral, and not just those that agreed with his principles. It says the choice of the... I'll just read that a little bit later on. If I can just... There's not an awful lot of room up here, is there? The lectern. I actually do have another lectern at home, which I must, which we had at one time, and I saw it the other day, and I need to actually get that out here. If we turn over to Revelation, let's see. Again, somewhere under here, I had some notes. In Revelation 17, we need to be aware that the link between the Catholic Church has always been with the governments of this world, where it says in chapter 17 verse 1, there came one of the seven angels that had the seven vials and talked with me, saying, come and see, come here and I'll show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. And it says very clearly in verse 15, where it says, the waters that you saw where the whore sits are people, multitudes, nations and tongues. So that sits on peoples, multitudes, nations and tongues, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of a fornication. So here we see this, certainly the previous pope, having this incredible string to his bow, in that sense, that he took down the communist world. And within the Telegraph on Wednesday, that's the day after the Pope was announced, it says, leaders from around the world offer their congratulations. They said, religious leaders of all faiths joined together last night to welcome the election of the Pope, and it goes on, not only religious leaders, but also so many political leaders as well gave a welcome to this particular Pope. Now, what we need to also ask ourselves is, why did he actually choose the name that he chose? Why did he choose the name of Benedict? And in that light, you know, there's been quite a bit of talk about the prophecies of Malachi and various other Catholic prophecies, and wondering how these are being fulfilled. I got something I just downloaded from Newsmax.com, which gives a little bit of background, and this was actually posted on April the 3rd, so it's before the Pope was actually elected. But it says, when the cardinals of the world pick John Paul's second successor, they may well be choosing the next to last Pope. The Pope who then follows this choice in the chair of St. Peter's will be the last Pope, and after his reign, Rome will be destroyed. Such has been the prophecy of St. Malachy, an Irish bishop, who at his death in 1148 was discovered to have left behind a prophetic list of all future popes, beginning with Pope Celestine II, whose papacy began in 1143. Malarkey included a single line in Latin identifying a characteristic of each pope, and historians say that Malarkey's predictions, where he listed just 112 popes, has been amazingly accurate. Now, again, we remember we're dealing with lying spirits here. There's no question. We can't take what is being said as, you know, this is the way it's going to be. But if these lying spirits want to give credence to a particular pontiff, then obviously they're going to have to get certain things right. Now, John Paul II, which is the 110th, was called the solar eclipse, or from the toil of the sun. And the corresponding pope was John Paul II, and he was born apparently during an eclipse of the sun, and like the sun he came out of the east, which was Poland, and like the sun he visited countries all around the globe. So they try and tie these various popes in. Today the final two prophecies are yet to be fulfilled. The 111th prophecy is Gloria Oliva, or Olivier, the glory of the olive. The meaning of the olive is unclear. The order of Saint Benedict, notice, not St. Malarkey, has claimed that this pope will come from its ranks, and St. Benedict himself prophesied that before the end of the world his order, known as the Olivetans, will triumphantly lead the Catholic Church in its final fight against evil. Now, the reason why this becomes significant to us is that this is what was in the pope's mind in choosing the name Benedict. Undoubtedly, he knows these prophecies. They look to these prophecies, and they look at the various predictions. And the 112th prophecy says that in the final persecution of the Holy Roman Church, there will reign Petrus Romanus, Peter the Roman, who will feed his flock amid tribulations, after which the seven-hilled city will be destroyed, and the dreadful judge will judge the people. So those are the prophecies, and then that's the end. That's the end of all the popes. In the Malarkey prophecy. Now, as I say, they're lying spirits, and they could well find that it's not the same at all. But I want to bring this out not so much because of the prophecies, but because of what was in the mind of the Pope himself in choosing this name. Regarding the Olivetans, it says a branch of the white monks of the Benedictine order, founded in 1319. It owes its origin to the ascetic fervour of Ptolemy, St. Bernard Ptolemy, a gentleman of Siena and professor of philosophy. Now, this is coming from the Catholic Encyclopedia. He said to have vowed himself to religion in gratitude for the recovery of his eyesight through the intercession of the Virgin Mary. In fulfilment of his vow, he left home in 1313 and went into the wilderness to forsake the world and give himself to God. Two companions of his also accompanied him. They settled on a bit of land. There was a mountain top, and they therefore had this. They were somewhat aggressive in their asceticism. And for 6 years later, they were accused of heresy and summoned to give an explanation. They then went down and they gave an explanation on how this particular pope. Actually had a vision or a dream or something, and he saw them, certain people bow before him, and he therefore linked it with these particular group of people, and he gave them, the Mount Hermitage was renamed Mount Oliveto in memory of Christ's agony and his perpetual reminder to themselves of the life of sacrifice and expiatory penance that they had undertaken. So it is a very ascetic order that they've actually chosen. And we need to be again aware that this goes all the way back. We turn to Colossians. In Colossians, we find here, and particularly it's pertinent to us now, just coming after the Passover, where it talks here about verse 13, and you being dead in your sins and uncircumcision of your flesh, has he quickened together with him, having forgiven all your trespasses, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, that was contrary to us. In other words, the sins. This is chapter 2, Colossians 2, verse 14. So he takes the actual sins themselves and nailed those sins to the cross. And having spoiled principalities and powers, this is the demon world now, he made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in it. So let no man, notice a man, therefore judge you in meat or drink or in respect of a holy day or the new moons of the Sabbath days. Because these are feast days. and we will be having the Night Groups Remembered tonight. We'll be followed by a holy day tomorrow. There'll be eating, there'll be drinking, there'll be a celebration. It's a type of a great rejoicing tonight. And yet that doesn't go down well at all with the concepts, particularly of the Benedictine monks. Now remember, what actually happened, St. Benedict, what they, in fact they did, is that he preserved the Roman values. He had the Benedictine rule, the book with several chapters long, and he preserved the values of the Roman Empire and the Roman ideas right through the Middle Ages. And his rule was applied in the monasteries, and it gave the ascetic nature to the monasteries, and it also gave a nature as to how the monks were to basically give all their money away to the church. Just hold it, the church then holds all the money and all the wealth, and they therefore become its subjects. It's a very much a right wing approach, very much a right wing approach. And here it says, which are a shadow of the thing to come, but the body of Christ judge you, as the ellipses is, let no man beguile you in your reward, in a voluntary humility and worshipping of angels, intruding into things that he has not seen and puffed up his fleshly mind. And these people worship the saints, and they worship all the great plethora of the saints and various angels and so on, and not holding the head from which all the body and joints and hands having nourishment are knit together and increase with the increase of God. And so it gives the and it talks about how the ordinances of men that are touch not, taste not, handle not, that are perish with the using after the commandments and the doctrines of men. This is asceticism, and this very much is part of the thinking regarding the Benedictine monastic thinking. In this one, on the 20th, it says, by choosing the name of Benedict, the new Pope immediately hinted at a kinship between himself and one of the Church's most celebrated historical figures, but one never closely linked to the papacy. Saint Benedict, the 6th century founder of the Benedictine monastery at Mount Cassino, is regarded as the father of Western monasticism. Indeed, more recently he was proclaimed patron saint of all Europe. Notice, he is the patron saint of Europe, Saint Benedict. The future saint was so repelled by the licentiousness of the Roman of Rome of its day that he fled to a cave east of the city to start a new life as a hermit, and later the rule of Saint Benedict offered guidance to those seeking to devote their lives to God, not in isolation as anchorites, but as a group of monks in a monastery. They actually preserved the Catholic Church right the way through the Middle Ages, and it wasn't just the Catholic Church, it was the Roman ideas, the Roman ideals, the Roman education came through the Middle Ages, and they came through the Dark Ages, and they came through it within the monasteries. There's also another, the last Benedict, with Benedict the 15th, was actually in the First World War, and he was trying to make peace. And again, you've got this olive idea, the olive branch, and trying to make peace, and links up, you can tie it up perhaps even with Jerusalem or whatever. It says, of the more recent Benedicts in the 18th century, Benedict the 13th denounced the extravagance and worldliness of his cardinals, and Benedict the 14th was admired by giants of the Enlightenment such as Voltaire, many of whom were no friends of the Church. The last Benedict was elected to the office only a month after the outbreak of the First World War, and spent most of the pontificate wrestling with a conflict and its aftermath in an era in many ways as unpromising for the Church mission as today. So we see an individual that has chosen a name that does tie in with the Catholic prophecies, and certainly he must be aware, he's got to be aware of those Catholic prophecies. He's not going to be unaware of them, and it must have some bearing on his choice of name, certainly. Turn over to Revelation 18 now, just briefly. Read this and close. Or just in 17. In 17 it says about these 10 nations that of Europe, and again remember Benedict is the patron saint of Europe. It says verse 16, the 10 horns which you saw upon the beast will hate the whore, and will make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. So again, these malarkey prophecies, they tie in with what is found in Scripture. But it says to us, and it says very, very clearly to us, in verse 4 of chapter 18, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you are not partakers of her sins." And remember, it's not just her, the whore, she's the mother of harlot daughters as well, and all the doctrines and the ideas of these harlot daughters. "Come out of her, my people, that you are not partakers of her sins, that you do not receive of her plagues." So there are going to be these plagues that will occur. "For her sins have reached to heaven, and God's remembered her iniquities. Reward her even as she rewarded you, and double to her double according to her works. In the cup which she's filled, to her double, how much she's glorified herself. And therefore," in verse 8, "shall her plagues come in one day, death, mourning, famine, and shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her." So again, tie it in with the prophecies from the Catholic Church, and it's an exact reversal of what in fact is the truth. But be aware that these prophecies were in the mind of the Pope, undoubtedly, when he chose that name Benedict, and therefore it gives an idea as to where he wants to actually make an impression within the world.